microwaved coffee.
What's going on?
I watched all of Devs.
Oh, and what did you
it
think?
It was so good.
It's great, right?
So good. It made me start researching. Like, I want books now on, like...
on that stuff.
On, like, time. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to learn more.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was so crazy.
The have you ever read the IMDb page for Back to the Future? I think it's the IMDb page. Basically, they ask the creators a bunch of questions. Like, fans try to trip them up. And they have, like, a solid explanation for everything that happens in that movie.
Yeah.
It's like, it's pretty brilliant. Like, I didn't know they did that much research, especially for like a movie like that in the 80s, you know?
Yeah.
It's like a fun movie or whatever, but
yeah, it's a fun movie.
It is like solid. But, like, they could not break them.
But people with that study that stuff, like, find flaws in that, or in the theories, obviously, because there's been a lot more thinking since the 80s.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I was reading.
You should read it. It's like, it's really interesting. They ask them like really complicated questions and they're like, nope, we got an answer for that.
Yeah, too. Yeah, no.
Yeah, yeah. And most people, a lot of people get mad at the whole like Marty's parents not recognizing him or whatever. And the creator was, or the writer was like, he was like, do you remember? And he's like, if I asked you right now to remember someone from 20 years ago that you met for 1 week,
for, yeah,
you're not going to remember them. He's like, you're full of shit. You would not remember them.
Yeah. I mean,
like, you would remember them vaguely, but you wouldn't be like, that is the exact person that, no, you wouldn't.
Nobody has a picture of him playing at the prom.
Oh, yeah, no, probably not. Because at that time, it was in the 50s.
Yeah.
And like cameras were not something that everybody had readily available, especially in teenagers. No,
but I mean, yeah, like, right, the school must have been taking, you know, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
The only thing that I think people have issues with is him not being born in Back to the Future 2.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm. Sure. Like, they never had him or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just like, I don't know. Well, obviously, there's no way of knowing if he would exist if he went back and didn't exist.
Yeah.
Oh, we were watching it the other day because it was when we went to Mammoth. It was playing in our room.
Oh, cool.
And Kyle was like, oh, who plays his daughter? And I started laughing and I'm like, that's him. All three parts are him. And he was like, what? And I'm like, yeah, he plays the daughter, the son, and then himself, obviously, like the dad. Yeah. I'm like, and Kyle's like, oh my God, I did not know that.
I'm
like,
yeah,
he's pretty, isn't he? He's a pretty girl.
Yeah. And then, like that one time Lester, we were at Hitachi and Lester, it was me, Richard, and then Justin, I think. I think we spent like 4 hours on Skype talking about time.
Oh, yeah.
I think I had it saved somewhere. Yeah. I must have lost it already. But I saved it because I was like, we talked for so long, we didn't do any work. I like that stuff a lot.
Yeah.
The show was like really cool though. Like
great actors, really interesting. Like I didn't feel bored throughout that
show.
And I really thought I was going to, because I'm like, I don't know if I'm gonna be able to sit through this.
Yeah.
But it was just so good.
Yeah.
And they seemed so short, even though they weren't short.
They weren't
episodes,
short, yeah.
But I was like, oh my God, it's already done.
There was things that I was like, oh, that was kind of predictable type thing. Like the bum, like the homeless guy outside.
Oh,
like that twist. And then I'm probably spoiling for all, I'm like, if you haven't watched it already, I think you are not
there's a twist in the end. No.
Yeah. But yeah, the ending when they're in the cube, that was surprising,
so sad
to me, because but then it made sense, like as it happened I was like, well, that makes sense based on the theory that they're presenting or whatever. Because there's like three basic time things or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was really, really cool. And then the way they show time, like when they start showing like the different scenarios, like when the girl's walking out of the building and then there's like, and then she walks out again.
Yeah,
all
the outcomes.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was a really, really great show.
Really cool show.
But yeah. Kyle finished Killing Eve. Which I was just telling you guys
Yeah.
about. I think you guys watched the first episode, right? I think we watched it here.
Yeah, it's the one I want to watch. But with once Sandra I do, I'm just going to binge
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah, you will binge it. Like, I think I started watching it when the quarantine first started. And I was like, I can't stop. At one point, I stayed up till like 4 a.m. And I was like, I can't stop watching this show. Maybe it's I'll on Hulu.
I'll watch that one yeah. next, I think. Because after this one, I was like, there's nothing I really, really want to watch. Because I already watched Fleabag, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, well, this is... Devs was one that I wanted to watch when it was announced. For a long time,
yeah.
But I didn't have... Or you couldn't watch Hulu in Mexico, even yeah. with the VPN. They would, like, kill it right away. And then... Yeah, I didn't know about this show. The only show I'm waiting for now is The Foundation. But that doesn't come out till September or something.
What's
like
that?
That's the one on Apple Plus. It's on a book. It's based on a, like, science fiction
yeah.
book by Isaac Asimov. It's the guy who wrote iRobot.
Oh,
so iRobot's okay. a book, and it's mm-hmm. like based on the same world as The Foundation, but The Foundation is like the first book in that series. Yeah,
nice.
And yeah, if you want to watch the trailer, iRobot, it's on your Apple TV. There's a trailer.
Oh, cool.
It looks cool.
Yeah, I'll check it out. I gotta start watching The Sopranos because I saw the trailer for the movie and it looks amazing.
I thought about it when I finished Devs. I was like, should I start The Sopranos? And then I just got lazy and I was like,
yeah.
I don't want to do it. I'm not going to do it.
It's a big commitment.
Uh-huh.
You know. Anyways, speaking of new shows and movies. Oh, by the way, this is Microwave Coffee Podcast, and I'm Kishan Dundee.
And I'm Ivan Ortega.
And I'm Justin Park.
He.
On Friday, director Steven Soderbergh released his latest film, No Sudden Move, which you can now watch on HBO. We're not sponsored by HBO or the film No Sudden Move, but... If you'd like to sponsor us, we'd be happy to partner up with you, HBO. So, for those of you who don't know, cool. some of Soderbergh's films include Out of Sight, Logan Lucky, and Haywire, which I recommend to Vanessa because it has both Ewan McGregor and Michael Fassbender.
Oh my goodness.
Her two guys are in it. And like several of his films, his new movie is about... a group of criminals who come together for a job. So, today we're going to look at the true story behind one of his trilogies. So, let's talk about Anthony Pino and the real Ocean's 11. This is a really fun research to do. by the way, the movie... aside from like the title and the number of characters has nothing to do with the story. So it's not really like, it's not based on that story. So yeah. nothing that I'm about to say was like happens at a casino or whatever, nor does it have like really handsome lead guys as their gang. But, and then just a little side note, there's different sources stating that another one of the key members was a leader, but for this episode, I'm going to go with Anthony Pino as the leader of the group, just because that's what most of them said. So normally I would tell you a little bit about our subject and their life growing up, but unfortunately there isn't much because, you know, professional criminals, they're good at staying off the grid. So we don't really know a lot about their home life or them growing up. In 1947, Anthony Pino got an idea to rob the Brinks building, which was located on the corner of Prince Street and Commercial Street in the north end of Boston, Massachusetts. Boston. It's always Boston.
Yeah, I was like, of course it's Boston.
If it's criminal and it's the 50s, it's either Boston or it's New York. There's no other place. The first person to join the robbery plans was a man named Joseph McGinnis. So that's the other guy that they think might have been the leader.
Yeah.
The two men soon realized that they were going to need a large crew to pull this off. So first they hired Joseph O'Keefe, who is also known as Specs. And they hired another guy, Stanley Gucciora, which would serve as the strong arms. Both of those guys would be the strong arms of the group. So it is kind of like in the movie where they're like, we need a driver. We need a strong man. We need a... Yeah, so like they did do that. Next, they hired Pino's brother-in-law, Vincent Costa, as a lookout. and Joseph Sylvester Banfield as a getaway driver.
They all have names of criminals.
It's all yeah. 1950s criminal, like the most 1950s criminal names you could ever think of. I mean, you couldn't make this up in a movie. They then hired Joseph Ignatius Faherty, who was the he was an armed robbery specialist. That was his official title.
Wow, nice.
And, my name tag says at work.
Yeah, I know. Armed robbery specialist. For more backup, they hired Adolf Maffey, a.k.a. Jazz. Coolest name ever. Michael Vincent Geegan, Thomas Francis Richardson, and Henry Baker, bringing the total to 11. The heist wouldn't take place until 1950. So from Pino's idea, they spent 3 years.
Wow.
Planning this out.
Wow, that's a long time.
A long time. Well, I mean, Brinks is like, you know, even back then they were very it was like, highly it better be secure. A lot of money. It's a lot of work, yeah. So they spent months casing the building and its staff members. They studied them closely. They would even, Anthony Pino even learned the pattern of the lights turning on and off in the offices. So he knew exactly when people left work, when they clocked in, and when they were going to be there. And here are the most important facts that they found of the building. The goal was not just money, but there were also checks, money orders, and other securities. I'm going to call it treasure to not make it so long. So the treasure. So the treasure was located on the second floor. This meant that the men had to go through 5 locked doors before getting to that second floor. And what they did was they planned to break in once a night and switch out one lock at a time. They would take the lock cylinders, make a copy of the key for themselves, and then put it back that same night.
Dang.
So then that way, no one noticed that anything went wrong.
Yeah.
So when the employees came back in the morning, everything the was back to normal. Yeah. So they did that for several days.
Smart.
Very smart. Yeah. Next was Joseph Banfield's role. He was a getaway driver. They broke into a dealership and stole a sweet, sweet 1949 green Ford steak body truck. And for 2 months, they drove the getaway route. So they practiced it every night for 2 months. And also figured out alternative routes in case they needed it. Then came the outfits, because you got to have them. You got to have some good outfits for this. Like everything else, this was also meticulously planned. They copied the Brinks employees' outfits as close as they could. They wore navy pea coats, leather gloves, a chauffeur's cap, and Halloween masks to cover their face. Hmm. So everything else, they look like a Brinks employee with the exception of the mask.
Mike Myers.
Yeah, Michael Myers. Just as a warning, don't Google the images of the mass at night. They're absolutely terrified. It's the most terrifying thing I've ever seen. I mean,
I want to see it now.
Go ahead. It's like every other Halloween costume in the 50s. They're just equally terrifying.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
They're horrifying, right? Like, that's the scariest shit I've ever seen.
Is this?
Yeah. Like, that's terrifying. What is that?
Yeah. What? Why?
Why? Why is that available for people to wear on Halloween?
Oh my God.
Anyway. I want one.
Yeah.
Let's keep one. Just kidding.
You don't want one because then I'll turn it into Billy and start pulling pranks on you.
No.
Billy.
So they attempted, when everything was said and done, finally 3 years after planning this, they attempted the heist not once, not twice, but 6 times. One little thing would go wrong and then they refused to carry it out. So they would like...
put the locks back and...
Well, the locks they kept because nobody knew they switched them.
Yeah.
So they didn't need to switch that, but they just...
They
would get really close and they'd see, you know, someone look shady on the corner and they'd be like, no, never mind. So they needed everything to go perfect. The closest they got on one of those attempts was getting down the street from the building and aborted last minute. So they were very careful about who was around, what time it was, and all that stuff. Then finally came the day. So on January 17th, 1950, Joseph McGinnis would be the only member not participating in the heist. He would stay behind as an alibi for some of the members. There were 5 employees in the building at the time, which the gang knew since they had been like stalking them for months, even years. They made the employees lie face down on the floor and then tied their hands behind their back and taped their mouth shut. They made their way to the treasure and cleaned out the building. It took 35 minutes.
Damn.
Everything, yeah. Before leaving, they heard a buzzard go off. Now, the entire time that they had been studying this, they had never heard a buzzard. So they kind of freaked out because they were like, what the fuck is that? And it kept going off. So one of the...
It was like a toaster oven or
something. Yeah. Panic, abort. So one of the gang members took the tape off the employee's face and asked them what the buzzard meant. And they said, because they said they hadn't heard it before, the employee said it was likely the garage attendant trying to get in. So he usually came in around that time. He came in at different times, so that's why they didn't know exactly when he was coming in. And two of the men went to the garage to let the attendant in and capture him. But once the garage attendant saw them, he walked in and was just like, sup, and kept walking. Because he thought they were employees. Like, he was at a faraway distance where he couldn't see their face, but he saw their outfits. And so he was like, oh, cool, just another Brinks employee. And they were like, cool, one less person we have to torture. So they just, like, let him go. Once exiting the building, 8 of the members went to Adolf Malfi's house, Adolf Malfi's parents' house. So not to his house, to their family's house. Vincent Costa had stolen a Ford sedan and left in that. Michael Geegan left separately because he needed it was important for him specifically to establish an alibi because he was out on parole. So they really needed him to get one. Anthony Pino and Joe Faherty left Maffey's parents' house shortly after getting there to determine their alibis. Joseph Banfield was in charge of getting rid of the truck. So they all kind of separated, but very strategically. The men stole a total of $2,775,395.12. That is only the cash. That does not include the checks, money orders, or securities. Altogether, they stole what's worth over $30 million today.
Dang.
So they got...
Not bad.
Got a good amount.
They didn't get caught neither.
Yeah. So let's talk about statute of limitations at the time. In 1950, the federal statute of limitations was 3 years, and the state statute of limitations was 6 years. So altogether, they just needed to keep quiet for 6 years, and they would be free, and they could keep the money, and no one, they could openly say they robbed the bank, and they couldn't, nothing could be done to them. The FBI was kind of fucked with evidence. I mean, these guys were like really, really careful. When they interviewed the employees at Brinks, they said that these guys seemed to know what they were doing. And so they kind of suspected that maybe they had worked there because they didn't know how they knew so much. Everything was very calculated. And they said that they looked comfortable and confident with every move they made. So they were like, yeah, these guys knew their stuff. When asked how many robbers, the employees couldn't even give that exact amount. Because they asked the employee said, we think there was 5 to 7. But they couldn't tell because the men didn't speak much. It was like limited communication between the two of them. And their footsteps were so quiet because of their rubber shoes. So they couldn't even hear people walking around them.
And they were wearing the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so like if you're laying on the floor, everybody looks the same to you. Mm-hmm. Pretty much they're wearing the same outfit. Of course, there was no description of what the men looked like. Because of the horrifying masks. So they couldn't even give them that description. Here's what the FBI did have. One of the robbers left their chauffeur's cap there. Like he had dropped it and left it there. They also had the tape and rope used to hold employees. But as we know, that's not shit. Because back then, DNA evidence wasn't like great. There was no fingerprints because the men were wearing gloves. The most solid piece of evidence that they had was that the robbers took 4 guns from Brinks. And luckily, Brinks had the serial numbers to those guns. But the problem, of course, is if nobody finds those guns, in some other crime, then what are you gonna do? It doesn't really help much. So Brinks offered a $100,000 reward to anybody who could come forward with information. That's about $1.1 million today.
Wow.
That's a shit ton of money. I don't think I've ever heard of anybody offering that much money.
Yeah.
I mean, unless it's like the Zodiac or someone like really, really prolific.
Wow.
Yeah. If you've ever watched a movie that takes place in the 1950s, there's like a crime every day, all day. Like, especially in Boston, like we talked about earlier, like it's always
Chicago.
It seems Boston. Like crimes were happening like literally every 2 seconds there. So after interviewing many witnesses, they got only one piece of valuable information. Someone came forward and said that they saw a green Ford Steak body truck parked outside the building the night of the robbery. On February 4th, 1950, so about a month after the robbery, there was a group of kids playing by Mystic River where they found one of the guns. I don't want to give advice to criminals, but like, don't throw shit in the river or in a creek or in a lake. Like, it's going to get found. Or in the attic. It's not going to go anywhere. Get that shit in the ocean or burn it. I don't know. Like, just don't throw it in there. The next day, a police officer found the second of four guns in a dump the next town over. So luckily for the criminals, the guns were too rusted. They couldn't really do anything with them. They saw the serial number, but there was like not much other evidence they can get off of it. On March 4th, there were truck parts found in bags across town in a dump. And those truck parts matched the green Ford. So they were like parts for that specific car. And this was the most helpful part of the evidence that they found, because the location where they found it was Staunton, Massachusetts. And the reason that's helpful is because two of their suspects on the top of their list lived in Staunton. And those two guys were Joseph O'Keefe and Stanley Gucciora, who were in the gang. The FBI thought, oh, this is it. Like, we got our guys.
Mm-hmm.
And then they realized, oh, no, we don't. All we have are these two guys that have a criminal history and that live here. Like, literally nothing else. So they were forced to let them go because they both had alibis for that night. Here's the thing about criminals. So they had to wait 6 years, just 6 years. And then they had $30 million. The thing is that criminals...
They couldn't
love
wait.
Breaking the law. They love it with a passion. They can't do stay it again. Still. So Keefe and Gucciora, who were the two guys that lived in that town where the guns were found, these idiots immediately went to go rob two more places. Like, immediately.
Right after
they let them out. Yeah. And they were caught immediately. So they were arrested. O'Keefe was sentenced to 3 years. While Gucciora was sentenced to 4 to 20 years. I don't know why he got so much more.
Yeah.
Especially since I think O'Keefe was on parole. Mm-mm. Or one of them was on parole. But I don't know. When they were going to
I guess that would be a good way to stay quiet.
Just like have it with...
Yeah, do a crime that's like...
Seven. Oh, so they throw you in jail and you're like,
whatever. Yeah, that's it.
Oh, that's true. I guess so. Just serve some time for like a minor thing. And
when you get out, you're rich.
Yeah, that's true. When they were going to trial, the FBI started noticing that there was a group of guys in Boston that were contributing to these two guys' fund, like criminal fund, like to bail them out. And they're like, that's fucking weird.
Yeah.
Because why are these guys? Because it was in a different part of town.
They're so stupid.
Yeah. And they're also like, how do these guys have all this money that they keep contributing to their bail fund to? And they're like supposedly working class men. So since they lived in the same area as the Brinks robbery, investigators decided to go get their alibis. Like, they're like, okay, we need an alibi from all these guys that are giving money to these guys. So Anthony Pino said he left home or he was at home until about 7 p.m. that night. He then walked to the closest liquor store, which was owned by Joseph McGinnis, his other partner. And they were like, we're not just going to take an alibi from two criminals. Like, two criminals are not going to back each other up.
Yeah.
And then there was this cop, and he was like, fuck. They're not lying. Because that cop was in that same liquor store and saw both of them. So he's like, yep, they're telling the truth. They have solid alibis. They also interviewed the other guys. Some didn't have, like, as good of alibis, but no one can prove otherwise.
Yeah.
So Baker said he had dinner with his family and went for a walk at around 7 p.m. Then they interviewed Henry Baker, which, by the way, they interviewed them all separately.
Mm-hmm.
He said he was having dinner with his family and went for a walk around 7 p.m.
Mm.
Next, they interviewed Anthony's brother-in-law, Vincent Costa. And he said he was working and he got off at 5. He then went home and had dinner with his family and returned to work at guess what time? 7 p.m. So Joseph Faherty was the only one who had like a solid alibi. A lot of the guys, one of them that went for a walk, quote unquote,
mm-hmm.
said he didn't talk to anybody or run into anybody or see another living soul on his walk. So it wasn't like a great alibi, except for his family knowing that he left the house around that time. So Joseph Faherty had a solid alibi. He said he was drinking at a bar between 5 and 7:45, and there were several witnesses who had nothing to do with the crime who saw him. So they were like, well, we're fucked with that guy. This is my favorite. Joseph Banfield was interviewed. He was like, look, guys, I had a hell of a year. I started drinking on New Year's Eve and was wasted the entire month of January. He straight up said that to
me. Oh, my God.
Like, what the fuck? And the last guy, Adolf Maffey, didn't really have an alibi, but they also couldn't prove otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So they were like, oh, well. Little did they know that they had screwed themselves, because several of these guys said 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. I just happened to leave my house at 7 p.m. Even though they were dumb in attempting the other robberies, O'Keefe and Gucciora kept their mouth shut. So they didn't say anything while they were in prison. So months and then years go by and authorities hit a roadblock. They had reached the statute of federal limitations. So all these guys had to do now was wait 3 more years. And they're clear. They're halfway there.
Yeah.
It was 1954, and O'Keefe, who's one of the guys who committed that first, who went immediately and like did that robbery, he was becoming more and more of a fucking asshole. So he continued his criminal activity and was going in and out of jail. And every single time, he would contact the other guys for money to bail him out. And guess who was carefully watching? The cops. And so, of course, they're like, okay, these guys clearly had something to do with it because they're not related to him. Like, why do they keep asking him?
Yeah.
Why do they keep getting money? And he would just make the rest of the guys give money, bribe them, blackmail them, whatever. And in June of 1954, after he was released, O'Keefe's car, someone tried to run him off the road. And he knew something was up. So he kind of ducked his head down. And at that moment, several bullets went flying through his window. So someone was trying to kill him.
Yeah.
They were tired of his shit. This would be the first of several attempts on O'Keefe's life. A week later, O'Keefe and his new partner, he got a new partner in crime, and they went to Baker to ask him for money. And Baker was like, I'm so tired of your trash, pulls out a gun and shoots at him. So then O'Keefe fires back. And I don't know how this ended, but none of them got hurt. Like, neither one of them got hurt.
They're stormtroopers.
Yeah. They're like, yeah. Pew, pew, pew. Here's the thing, though. About a week after that, O'Keefe's new partner goes missing. He mysteriously disappeared and no one saw him again. So he's like,
I see.
Okay, yeah. People are after me. A week after that, someone shot at O'Keefe again.
How much of a jerk do you have to be?
I mean,
everyone just wants to
kill. What a douche. Everyone just wants to get rid of you at any cost. This time he was shot in the chest, but he survived.
Dang.
And he finally learned his lesson and he left town. But almost immediately after leaving town, he was arrested for possessing a gun and violating his parole. In August of 1954, he was sentenced to 2 years. So these were all like, luckily, I think because nobody got hurt, he was like getting these small sentences.
Yeah.
And every single time he'd ask these guys for money. So it is now December of 1955, 1 month before these guys are free, like free and clear. On January 6th of 1956, at 4:20 p.m., 11 days before these guys are free, O'Keefe rats him out. He sits down with the cops and he says, all right, what do you want to know?
Dang.
Yeah. On January 12th, the rest of the members are arrested. And on January 13th, indictments are placed. This Dang. Is 4 days before they would have been free. Faherty and Richardson fled the state and were placed on the FBI watch list and then were caught about a month later. So they didn't make it out too far. On July 9th of 1950.
Wait, does that matter now? Or because they know? They
no, it did because they were arrested. They were placed under arrest before the statute of limitations. Oh, okay. Yeah, but and then they ran away.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
On July 9th of 1956, after being transferred to a federal prison, because remember Gucciora, this entire time he had been in jail. He was the one that went with O'Keefe the yeah. first time. On July 9th of 1956, after being transferred to a federal prison, Gucciora died of a head injury in his cell. He supposedly slipped and fell.
Yeah.
And hit his head, but, you know.
Come on.
We'll see. Yeah. Kind of hard to believe. 8 of the remaining members were sentenced to life plus 2 to 10 years in prison. McGinnis wasn't at the robbery, but he got 8 life sentences, one for each member of his crew. Which is kind of crazy to me. Because he yeah. wasn't, like, actually involved. Obviously, he was involved, but mm-hmm. he wasn't there. So I'm
yeah.
like, that's kind of crazy. That's pretty. For his cooperation, O'Keefe got just 4 years. He was released in 1960, and they think he went under a new identity, moving to California. So they think maybe the FBI gave him a new identity.
No money.
He died in 1976. Dang. Anthony Pino was released in 1970. He died 3 years later. Baker and McGinnis both died in prison. Richardson was paroled in 1970. Geegan, Faherty, and Maffey were released in 1969. The member that died at the oldest age was Maffey, and he died in 1988. So they're still like, where the fuck is this money? This whole time they arrested them, they still can't find the mm-hmm. money. So they're going like a little nuts. But in 1956, that same year that they, or the year after their statute of limitations, the guys got arrested. There was a man, I don't know, I couldn't find out why, but he was arrested and he was found with $5,000 on him. $4,635 matched the cereals as a stolen money. So we're like, all right, five, a million guy? More to go. They don't know him. They don't think he was connected to the gang, not that they know of
yeah.
in any way. So they asked him where he got the money and he said it was his associates, Fat Joe. So they're like, we got to find Fat Joe. So they find Fat Joe and they finally track him down. And in one of his properties, in like a metal container, he was hiding $60,000.
Dang.
$51,906 of those dollars match the cereals. Dang. To this day, there are still $1,150,000 missing.
That money's gone.
Yep. Yeah.
They spent it.
And that's the story of Anthony Pino.
They did Dang. Spend
the
it.
Real Ocean's 11.
I wonder if at this point the money is worth more.
It must be.
Like selling the bill.
Yeah, you know, it must
because
be.
It's like an
the
old
bill for
dollar.
Money.
Yeah, like selling like whatever.
Yeah. I really
a
doubt they like
for
close
100,
the case.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Thank you as always to Wikipedia, FBI.gov, and BuzzFeed Unsolved.
I
am totally fine. If nobody got hurt, I'm totally cool with the statute of limitations, a short one, on robberies. I'm totally cool with that. Because I'm like, yeah, that's... I mean, if they lasted 10 years, fuck it. Just let them get away. I mean, if it's like a big bank, I'm not talking about like a mom and pop shop or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, just fuck it. Just let them go.
I mean, Wells Fargo steals money every few years anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, that's what I'm saying. Like, if they rob a major bank, just fuck it. Like, drop it and let it go.
What's his name? The CEO, right? From Wells Fargo. Stole money, basically.
Yeah.
And then just...
And then was giving it to, like, resign, criminal undergrounds.
And then they gave him...
Yeah.
They gave him a bonus for leaving.
Yeah. It's so fucked. But you know what? Like, but, you know, rape statute of limitations and murders are, like, super fucking short. And people get away with that heinous crime, like, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But with bank robberies, like, dude, we gotta find them. Anywho.
Yeah.
So stupid.
Yeah. I'm kind of bummed. I couldn't believe how they almost... I mean, days, and they could have gotten away with it. It's just bananas. But anyway, just
hold on for a few more days.
I know.
Somehow.
It's O'Keefe's fault, that fucking idiot.
All he had to do was hold out, because he was going to get money too, right?
He was going to also. That's the thing. I'm like, what? You could have fucking just been like, okay, I'm going to get my money and I'll get out of here. I'll bail myself out. Who cares? Yeah.
So dumb.
Anywho. Where can they find us?
At Microwave Coffee Podcast on Instagram. Yeah. And Microwave Coffee Podcast at gmail.com for any emails or information on who
where
stole
the money is.
Yeah, if you guys know where the money is,
how we can get
tell
some
us.
Of it.
Give us some.
Yeah.
We're broke.
We're very broke.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, go see Steven Soderbergh's new movie. No way. Yeah. Good cast.
Wait, you said it's on HBO,
it's on
right?
HBO. Yeah.
Cool.
Anywho.
Cool. Yeah.
Thank you, guys. We'll see you next week.
Bye. Could I get some more coffee?